This is CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. Thanks for tuning in. Got a pretty packed show lined up. Remember to join us and talk to us on Twitter on @CliffCentral.com, on @DMShowZA. You can also call in if you're dying to talk to us on 0861-555-189. Got a pretty packed show lined up. Is Musi Maimane getting politics lessons from F.W. de Klerk? What's going to happen at SONA 2016 next week? Kandla, the Constitutional Court, also next week, so a lot to talk about. Got a pretty esteemed panel in front of me, so I'll just go around and introduce anyone. First is Daily Maverick Associate Editor, Ranjeni Munusami. Ranjeni, how are you doing today?
Hi, King. How are you doing? It's good to be here after a long time.
Fantastic. Absolutely. Someone I haven't been on the show with, Richard Poplack.
It's a big moment, Kingsley.
I'm feeling the vibe, man. And our usual, my co-host, Greg Nicholson. Your usual face.
Yeah.
Does he qualify as esteemed as well?
No, I don't.
I'm not even a guest. It's just...
He's just like cleaning up around us and stuff, setting up the water.
Trying to get the Wi-Fi password.
That is, what's up with the Wi-Fi? Anyway, I think Gareth just had his hands full, didn't pay the Wi-Fi bill or something. Anyway, time to jump in. Ranjeni, I'd love to start with something you were at just today, I think. Nelson Mandela Foundation had a summit on racism. I don't know very much about this, so I'd just love to hear what happened, what's going on there.
Yes, well, they've been working with the Nelson Mandela Foundation, has been working with the Amicus Rada Foundation for several months now to set up an anti-racism network.
Okay.
And apparently they have about 80 organizations that have now lined up behind them to cooperate. So what they were announcing today was an anti-racism week from the 14th to the 21st of March. And they basically want South African society to basically rally and promote an anti-racist culture, whatever that means, and they want business, religious organizations, sporting organizations to try and run active or programs and activities that can actively promote the better racial relations, but a better race relations, but also take the debate, if that's what it is, beyond just condemnation, so that there are actual activities that that get people to denounce racist behavior, and also promote activities that that promote race relations. And I think that has been sorely missing. Sela Hatang, the CEO of the Nelson Mandela Foundation, was saying that many people relied on Nelson Mandela to play that nation building role, and then everyone kind of forgot about it when he left the presidency, and nobody actually took up that role. And he was saying that is not a Mandela project. It's supposed to be a societal project, and nobody has really paid attention to it. So I suppose it's a challenge to society now, particularly at this time when we've had these horrendous incidents, and everybody's bruised and scarred from these incidents, that there's now a challenge out there in the names of the two people who are amongst the highest icons in terms of the liberation struggle, now saying, we're opening up this invitation to you, please respond, work with us, let's get this right.
What sort of activities are these that are going to improve race relations? Is it sort of like multiracial ultimate frisbee? Is there like going to be feet cleansing? So what activities do they have in mind?
I'm not really sure. Look, there's lots of dialogues being planned. But, I don't know what exactly that will achieve. Like, this is a hard subject. Lots of people were speaking there from the Kathrada Foundation. Two people who were speaking there made the point that, for example, South Africa hosted the World Conference on Racism. I think that was 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And there hasn't been a proper program of action from that. And Nishan Bolton, who's the CEO of the Kathrada Foundation, was saying that, it's taken all this time. It's taken these horrendous incidents to actually get a stick up or light a fire under everyone to say it's about time that you acted on those. South Africa was the host of that conference. But although racism now is an international problem, you know, you see it with the Syrian refugees and how they're being treated in Europe, for example. And it's a global problem, but this is the only major issue in the world where there isn't a global program of action to tackle racism.
Mm. And I'd argue there's a reason for that, and that's because the structural elements of racism suit those in entrenched power situations.
Yes.
So my concern once again with civil society in this country is that they conveniently miss the actual root of the issue, which in this case is the society we live in is fundamentally unfair. Most of the economic power is in the hands of the white community in this country, and in fact I would not even say the white community. I'd say very few white people's hands.
Mm.
I mean, once again, we have a 0.1% here that is largely white, if not entirely white, and they pull the levers of power. So one wonders, with regard to race relations and you know, black and white frisbee games and all this other stuff. Are race relations the problem in this country, or is it a structural issue in which our society needs to be reconceived and rebuilt ground up?
Because we've seen these like promotions of dialogues before, because obviously there was that Durban sort of race summit, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, when there was a national social cohesion summit. I was there in Cliptown, and I can't remember a single thing that was achieved from that. Arts and Culture Minister Nati Mdetwa is holding similar sort of discussions right now. But you sort of wonder what these things are going to achieve.
You wonder what they're going to achieve in the context of Black Lives Matter, where you have a situation in the United States of America, and Ren Jenny has pointed out how global this issue actually is.
Mm.
What you have is white cops constantly shooting black men. You know, I was watching the Straight Outta Compton movie, where they play, you know, a central sort of theme in the movie is the footage from the LA riots and uprisings of the early 90s. And you think, how quaint. Like, one dude gets beaten up on video. Now we're watching people get shot all the time by cops. What needs to happen there is a structural societal reawakening. And I'm wondering if these things are being addressed in this context.
Yes, Sela Hatang was making the point that, you know, daily there are experiences, and he said, you know, he goes through every time he encounters a white person who is rude to him, he has to stop and think, is this just a badly behaved person, you know, is just rude, or is he being racist towards me? And you know, I asked a question there at the launch, is that okay, so you're going to have all these activities to promote the anti-racism message, but if you experience racism, what do you do? And I think that's a fundamental problem, because from farm workers to domestic workers to ordinary people in a restaurant, you've seen it at the race course. What do you do when you experience racism? You know, how do you tackle? Because it almost always results in some or other confrontation.
Mm.
You know, in the case of farm workers, their lives are sometimes at risk. Domestic workers, you know, if they speak out, they lose their jobs.
Yeah.
So what is the vehicle to be able to challenge racism? And, you know, I want to write about this today to be able to say, because what exists at the moment is the Equality Court. And for the life of me, I didn't know, is there like an Equality Court, like how there's a constitutional court? Do you go to this place and this is the, and you see a sign that says Equality Court? And I was only going to ask the question there that Nishan Balton said, actually, any magistrate's court can be an Equality Court. And I did not know that.
What do they mean by that?
It can be turned into an Equality Court. So your case that would, you know, I also don't know the mechanism. That you
is it
go
an element because of the constitution that's used, or that
I don't know, because you would think that something like is racism, if somebody is racist to somebody else, is that a criminal offense? So like, do you lay a charge at a police station and then that's investigated and goes to the Equality Court? You know, how is it processed? We don't know those things. I don't know.
But how do you prove racism?
This is it, because ultimately it'll be about the judge's perception whether this constitutes racism or not. So it'll have to be spelled out in legislation properly as to what constitutes, it's hate speech. Hate speech is a bit better to define, but it's clearer. but actions that are racist, how do you define that?
Yeah, or racist perception. I mean, Eusebius McKeyser in his book Run Racist Run quotes Daniel Bauer, I think, and this concept of racism receipts. Like, you don't actually get a receipt when someone's being racist to you. And were I being racist to someone? I'm white, for those listeners who can't tell. You know, I don't hand out a receipt. There you go. I was just racist. Once again, when you're looking at in a domestic worker or in a farm worker context, these people are locked into fundamentally unequal and unfair structural mechanisms. And once again, I think we butt up against this. Racism is hurtful and terrible. Racism is perpetuated by how society looks after these people, ultimately. And I think these things need to be addressed simultaneously with us dealing with race relations. Mm. You know,
I think as well one of the key failings of the government is failing to push through legislation on racism, because all of a sudden now, after these events and all this stuff on social media, racism is all of a sudden a huge issue again, or it's in the spotlight. And now the ANZ government is talking about pushing through certain parts of legislation to make racism hate speech and other aspects.
Well, Nathi Mteto, the Minister of Arts and Culture, was at this launch, and somebody asked him, so what will the legislation say? He said, I don't know. And this is the problem. It's a huge problem because he did say, look, there has to be a carrot and stick approach to it. But this issue about the penalty, how do you process it to get a penalty in the first place? Mm. But I think a lot of people, they made the point that the ANC case before the Equality Court may be a big test case. Because they have basically laid charges against Diane Kolabana, Penny Sparrow, and that councillor in
who's the other guy
in PE Roberts. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a political maneuver, obviously, by their party against the DA. But it will be a test case to see what constitutes racism, because it would be interesting to see how the judge pronounces on that.
I'd be interested in your thoughts. Just going around the table, can we confront racism in South Africa if we don't fundamentally shift the racial inequalities that I think Poplack was referring to before?
I mean, I was just about to jump in and say I fear that this is just focusing on what people say, and I think the real racism is what you were talking about. It's the farm workers, the domestic worker, when you can't feed your children because
you don't have access to equal education, you don't have access to equal healthcare. You actually you live in a different country.
Yeah, for me, I think that, for me, that's, we need to fix that.
And I'd say those systems as well.
Treat whatever they want.
I think the lower class gets the worst end of these things, but it goes beyond just the lower class and permeates other classes as well.
Well, I think there is some recognition now after these incidents and after there has been this dialogue on racism that it is the structural problems that perpetuate racism.
Absolutely.
So there are different approaches. For example, the National Development Plan talks about how an average black child will progress through the system, and all the avenues where there's a chance that he or she would fall off the system, and the chances of that child being kind of sabotaged in life by the structural inequalities is so great compared to any other child. And I think, you know, the idea behind the National Development Plan was to fix all the structural problems across the board. But obviously the National Development Plan has its own implementation problems. Now, the EFF, for example, is coming at it the other way. There needs to be a redistribution of land. There needs to be economic freedom, with the nationalization of mineral resources and the banks and things like that. So, you know, it's everybody has a different answer to how it's done. I'm not quite sure what the DA is saying about it, but I think they want
6 million like, real jobs.
Yeah, but I think they like the National Development. The National Development Plan also.
The only opposition party in history that has ever endorsed the development plan of the ruling
party.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
But once again, I think when you mentioned the development trajectory of a black child that's been listed in the NDP, the Stats General has actually laid out the statistics for a black child, a colored child, an Indian child, and white children in this country. That's where you see racism manifest. As terrible as our relations with one another on a one-on-one basis, or the stuff that we tweet or the stuff that we Facebook, however bad that may or may not be, and however wounding it may or may not be, until we address the statistical anomalies, or rather the statistical gulfs that exist between white kids and black kids in this country, then I don't think we've done anything.
Well, it's that, but it's multifaceted as well. I think the Sela Hatang from the Nelson Mandela Foundation was also saying that there needs to be change in people's homes as well, in terms of how they perceive racism and how they behave, because he was saying, you know, you get incidents, for example, where white kids, young white people who you think wouldn't still have, you know, such deep racist attitudes, assault or harm black kids because they are driven by something that's almost inexplicable, and it comes from the environment that they grow up in. And he was making the example that you can be watching television and Jacob Zuma comes on TV and the parent says something, and this manifests in this child's head that, you know, black people are stupid. And they act on it eventually. So, you know, it's, yes, there are big structural problems, but the problem with that is that it makes people dependent on somebody else fixing it. So everybody says, it's not my problem, I can't fix the system. You know, I can't do anything about it. Those who are in charge have to fix it. And you know, I think that with this conversation that's been opened up now, it says every single person here has a vested interest in doing something actively.
Now, the interesting thing about race perception in this country is that we live in different countries. A white upper middle class family, their interaction with black people is reduced entirely to master and servant. That has not changed in 25 years. How do you change something like that? I mean, how do you bring white people, black people, colored people into each other's lives? How do you do that sort of cultural blending? And I think you're 100% right. That does come down to individual responsibility. But it would be nice to hear someone have some sort of overarching plan that says, okay, we need some cultural melding in this country.
Yes, but you know, everyone talks about overt racism and subliminal racism, and you know, it happens at different levels. Like, for, we were going to speak just now about the story, the Mail and Guardian story about de Klerk allegedly giving lessons to Musi Maimane. You know what? I didn't know the fact when I read that story on Friday morning. I didn't know the facts behind it, whether it was true or not. But the first thing that irritated me about it is that, why do you think a black man would need lessons from a white man?
Especially that dude.
Yes. You know, because the term giving lessons, it's so condescending.
Yeah, and that's deliberate. It's not meeting with secret meetings, which is scandalous
because,
in itself.
You know, if it was Helen Ziller meeting with F.W. de Klerk, it would have been the two of them are plotting. That was what the term that would have been used. Mm. That there's an agenda, and you know, it's subversive, but they are plotting. Mm-hmm. Because it's Musi Maimane, he's a young black man, suddenly he can't be capable of plotting. He needs to be able to take lessons.
But that headline was cynically calculated to sort of suggest, you know, there was all sort of dog whistle things that someone who isn't South Africa or isn't familiar with our culture wouldn't get. Right. I have a friend staying at my house right now. He's from Canada, and you know, he'd read that headline and not understand it. It's like, okay, well, that sounds okay. I guess it's, you know, two guys are hanging out having tea. You know,
what kind of lessons? Guitar lessons, well, you know, French lessons.
That sounds great. Yeah. You know, old guy teaching young guy. You know, those sort of historical and racist perceptions wouldn't be there. But you know, one thing I'm really interested in is, Kingsley, in your sort of views on this as a Kenyan. I mean, is this a South African thing? Is this a South African obsession, or do you guys have the same conversations in Kenya?
I mean, so in Kenya, it's largely a tribal issue. Mm-hmm. Inequality still does play out, where you've got. And we saw this in the post-election violence. I'm not sure if you guys followed it too closely, but between 2007 2008, sure. It flared up. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that was previously discussed every day, that different tribes and there's economic inequalities amongst different tribes. But we saw that it is real. So it's not a South African thing, man. Mm-hmm. It's not a South African thing.
It's just, I think in South Africa, it's because of the imbalance of power, both politically and economically. Mm-hmm. You know, there was this process of political change, and it was successful to an extent, and the economic transformation has been really bad,
completely stalled. I mean, you could argue deliberately botched. To the point where the stuff was, there were deals being made, and deals were made to I guess withhold any sort of real economic transformation. And the white minority that was very, very wealthy prior to the fall of apartheid is now even wealthier.
So this is why Julius Malema is so strategic when he says people like Nelson Mandela, who he uses as the figurehead of that time, sold out by allowing a process of political change and making so many compromises on the economy.
Absolutely. And I think there were all sorts of theories that were in play in those days. The trickle-down theory, if we don't rock the boat, which was one of the big maxims of the time, if we don't rock the boat economically, and if we open up the country, and if we allow the investments to stay where they stand and the industrialists, we don't drive them into the sea and set them on fire, which we probably should. You know, if we don't do any of that stuff, if we don't rock the boat, then things will trickle down. I think we're much, much less naive nowadays. And any sort of talk of trickle-down economic theory has been completely... I mean, anyone who still believes that really does need to go to an asylum.
The problem, however, is there's no real talk of no decision on a replacement.
Yes. Everybody's
on a replacement lost. Of course, there is.
We've lost faith in those like traditional conventional economics and the trickle down theory, but then we haven't decided on anything else.
Well, Colin Mayonnaise closed his bank account. That's major.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So you know that should like. Bring a complete halt to the
like
entire...
That's like a bad guy in the movie giving you his one gun when you know he's got a gun in his ankle.
No, but I don't think his bank accounts combined is going to bring a fall of the economic system anyway.
So I was watching James Bond yesterday and he did that. That's a classic
that's an old trick.
The guy just killed himself. Yeah. If you're just tuning in, talk of suicide on the Daily Maverick show, Cliff Central, just about halfway through the show and... Pop, like, I want to talk about something you mentioned, which was the 6 million, you know, jobs planned by the DA, and they had the big march last week. And
this fascinates me.
Yeah,
how do you walk for a job? I mean,
well, I was there.
Greg, you were there. What happened? You were there. What happened?
Did you get a better job?
No, when Guardian.
I still have a job.
He's still
and
here.
I didn't.
The guy's still here.
Didn't get any other offers while I was there. But
New York Times called Jack. That's right. As he was finished.
We heard you're walking.
Yeah. And you know
that's what we're looking for.
That's the journalistic skills that we're looking for. Yeah.
What happened?
I do walk a lot in my job. Actually, I go to the marches.
Okay.
No, so it was actually a little bit awkward, sort of walking through. You know, when I arrived at this jobs march, and they always, for some reason, the DA starts there. Their marches on the southwest side of Joburg in this sort of Westgate taxi rank area.
Yeah, anyway, yeah.
I get there and one of the DA communications people sort of grabs me and is like, oh, the media holding area is over here. And me and other journalists just freaked out, thinking we're going to get locked up. Like,
put in a cage with Helen Zille.
That's right. So anyway.
You wouldn't come out.
I think, let's move on.
Let's move on, yeah.
So I slowly sort of escaped that little holding cage.
Okay.
And then slowly actually the crowd filled up. It was pretty decent. I'd say definitely over 10,000.
Yeah, it looks like about 15, I think.
And that's I think, a pretty strong crowd for a march that's quite uncertain. And I was asking a lot of people, why are you here? You know, what are we actually doing? And I think everybody's answer was elections.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everybody, basically. It's because the DA members think they can do better in elections, and some think they can do better in jobs for elections. Mm-hmm. But it was really just a rally. It was really a giant advertisement, I think.
Right.
It started because of a billboard, and we ended at a billboard, and the whole thing was a billboard just for elections to prove, I think, a little bit of strength on the DA's organizational capabilities, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And just to have Musi Maimane and particularly this other group of young leaders that they're trying to sort of champion as well on the front of the newspapers that day. I'm still a bit uncertain on the jobs policy.
Right. I mean, well, we all are. And this is the thing that still confuses me about the DA strategists. You recall the 2014 elections where you and I were on the streets of Johannesburg when there was the first jobs. That was another 6 million real jobs march. This occurred, I think it must have been March 2014.
When we had the...
And there was basically a riot on the streets. They were going to deliver a jobs paper
to
Lithuli House and basically incite what was basically a running battle with the cops in the street. And they got exactly what they wanted. It was very, very cynical, as these things always are, and a little bit revolting. And even then, it was like, well, 6 million real jobs, how? They built their election manifesto. There were some really, really good ideas in their election manifesto, all that were buried behind this nonsense about government being able to create jobs. Government doesn't create jobs. Government creates the environment in which jobs become possible.
But they are starting to push that line, I think, a lot more, and particularly with a guy like Herman Mashaba as their mayoral candidate for Johannesburg. He's been saying the same thing as the Freedom Free Market Foundation, I think, as the president or chair for a very long time. And I think that that is their general philosophy, that as the leaders of government, they would, you know, do things like, I guess the cliches are, cut red tape,
help small businesses,
incentives for small business, and those sort of things. But I don't, like, interestingly, I felt in the speeches when we arrived at the final destination and watched sort of house singer Busi do her thing on stage, then the speeches didn't really focus on those key aspects of how they are going to build jobs.
They always fly from the substantive issues.
And even though I do think the Democratic Alliance in this elections is trying to push away from just attacking the ANC and trying to show, or trying to at least convince voters, that they can be a viable alternative. And I think that started when they launched their Vision 2029 thing, videos, I guess, last year. And now they're sort of, and that was with their sort of a dreamy utopian South African future where everything's fantastic. And now I think they're just going to be doing little marches or little events or medium-sized events on things like maybe jobs, safety and security.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the DA strategy doesn't always hit the target. So, for example, with those billboards, they had the one side of the building was a DA billboard, and then the other side was a billboard in ANC colors with Jacob Zuma, which if you are on one side of town and can only see the ANC billboard, you think it's an ANC billboard, but whereas it was erected by the DA as an anti-ANC tactic or a stunt. And, you know, so you think, so what does this achieve? You know, in the mind of an ordinary South African who doesn't have a job, when you look up at the billboard, does it, what does it say to you? Does it speak to you? Does it give you hope that the DA would be able to create that job? And how would they do it? And, you know, these are the kinds of questions they need to ask themselves. The problem with the DA structure operating the way it has, I think one of the Sunday newspapers carried a graph of the, for example, the racial breakdown of their management structure, is I think that they want to think kind of new age stuff, and that, you know, they look at the kind of big budget campaigns in the United States and, you know, the big flashy advertisements and you know, the sophisticated messaging, and they try to impose that on a South African audience, whereas our problems and our perceptions and, you know, the are very different. So those kind of big budget advertising doesn't really work. I think the answer does rest with how they project themselves as an alternative. Because if they can say, here, the look in Cape Town, this is how we created these jobs, you know, areas that they control. This is where these people didn't have jobs. Here's how we created the jobs. This is what we want to do for the East Rand, or this is what we want to do for Rustenburg. And this is how we see these jobs being created. These are the impediments to creating these jobs. The ANC doesn't want to lift these impediments. We want to lift these impediments. So, you know, things that people can understand and where they can see that they will derive benefits from. That's how I think they will get votes.
One of the things the CEO of the DA, first of all, I find it very funny that a political party in South Africa has a CEO.
Yeah, I was just about to say, that's not...
Welcome to the Democratic
Alliance.
That's
not helping. Like,
the DA CEO,
business's best friend.
Paul Bowie, has told me at the march, was they've been putting in research, so they've got a full-time researcher and staff, and I guess they probably spend a fortune on trying to get market research as to what voters want and all these sort of stuff. The party's been looking at that for 2 years before this election campaign, so I guess that's basically since the end of the last election. Or maybe even before, they've been sort of working up to this election campaign, trying to get data and trying to poll people. I'd be fascinated actually to get inside you know, the DA control room.
Yeah.
I would love to see what this data is telling people.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, one of the things that makes us kind of bizarrely, you know, that makes the political space fairly anarchic, or at least the political analyst space fairly anarchic in this country, is that we have no polling data. We have no real numbers and no real science to work with. And I think the political party that gets on top of that certainly has an advantage. I wonder, and I'm sort of concurring with Ranjini here, I wonder if their strategists spend enough time on the ground, speaking to the ward, to the guys who are running the wards and who are in the wards on a constant basis. I'm always very, very impressed with their structural networks. I mean, you know, where you go to Alexandra and you see how well represented and how well organized they are in that township, that toe doesn't seem to connect with the brain. If you know what I'm saying, I don't know how many signals are running back and forth between the two. Moosey, when he was in Alex, was really, really well informed on what the issues there are. The issues there are not Nkandla; they're rats. You know, they're the fact that vermin run through the shacks, bite babies, cause sores, cause a night. That's one of the major issues in that township. And I just wonder how the brain trust is dealing with these very, very local issues.
How are you guys seeing Musi Maimane's performance, or as sort of the party leader going into this head election? Do you think he has the sort of the respect of the public, the profile to lead the DA into these elections after we've seen him be leader for almost, I think it's 8 months a year, almost something like that now?
You know, I'm really worried about Musi Maimane, and I'm worried that he's been set up to blunder or to fail. Because, you know, the more I look at him, I realize that, you know, I don't think it was the right time for Helen Zille to step aside when she did and to kind of just dump him with the leadership in the way that she did without preparing him properly, you know, and giving him a few months, perhaps as deputy leader, be able to kind of learn the ropes and define a role for himself in the DA. And, you know, it's becoming a real problem. And I think that the DA has suffered such terrible reputational damage with these incidents of racism. And, you know, I think it's been a big challenge for him to have to step up so quickly, you know, in this leadership role and have to deal with these internal problems. And, you know, this thing of the DA being a non-racial party is, you know, I don't even know what that's supposed to mean, you know, because it comes out of a party that's mainly served white people's interests. And you can't say that because they've got some black voters and some black people in the leadership now, so that, you know, they the party that most reflects South Africa's diversity. And I think he's trying to make this effort now to promote this, you know, he announced a series of initiatives, one, you know, like how to combat racism within the party, with how to get more black people into leadership roles. And also, he needs to be able to send a strong message to his members that he does not serve white interests. And that, he did say quite strongly that if you are planning to vote for the DA because, you know, you think that we will continue you can be a racist in the party, then please don't vote for us. So it is. But I just feel that, you know, the burden on him is far too big to be left alone to change something like that. That should have been a group effort by the DA, which included people like Helen Zille. Instead of her stepping aside and saying, it's done now, you have a black leader, good luck with that. You know, I feel it's been really unfair on him.
At the same time, though, I think there's accusations that Musi Maimane he doesn't really have control of the party, and Helen Zille and others are controlling things from the sides.
Yeah.
But so then I think if Helen Zille does obviously intervene, that will fuel those claims.
Yes, and you know, at the moment he's facing resentment from so many sides because you know, the conservative or the liberal base of the party is resentful because they think he's going to try and change too much too soon, whereas you've got what was termed as the Black Caucus on the other side who feel that he's the puppet of Helen Zille's clique, and that, you know, he's just pandering to what, you know, these the kind of old white leaders in the party want, and they've just they've basically just done a blackface with the party. So you know, he doesn't have the kind of universal support in the party that he needs to be run this project, and you know, it may end up in disaster for him.
It sounds like a lose-lose for Musi Maimane slightly.
It does sometimes feel that way, and I agree with Ranjini. It's he's been put. I mean, has another guy been punched as much as poor old Musi? I mean, the guy gets smacked so often. It's quite dispiriting to watch.
That's it. We're gonna have to go into a quick break. We'll be right back.
This is CliffCentral.com. It's date night, and your wife wants you to bring Ray to bed with you. Hmm? You suggested Tyrion, or maybe even Sheldon if she fancied something a little different. But no, Ray Donovan it is. So you get your tablet and you meet her in the bedroom. Because with Showmax for 99 Rand a month, you get to watch full seasons of the biggest series. On the couch, in the kitchen, in bed. Online anytime. So get to Showmax.com and get your 7-day free trial.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon, you're back with us on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. Lots of fun conversations. I think next we're talking about the new Rihanna album that came out last week.
It's got Anti, right?
Yeah, we go, man. Pop, like, I know you're all over that. Hey?
I'm all over that.
Ranjini's doing the dance.
No, I'm doing the Beyonce dance, the Coldplay Beyonce. You know, they released a new song, and Beyonce went to India to make it, and she's, there's this whole debate about cultural appropriation, really? Because she's in a sari.
Yeah, well,
and Indian garb, yeah.
Yeah.
What do we think? Appropriating or just...
Well, borrowing used to be a word.
I still have to see the video. I'm not going
to
judge it.
Yeah, I also don't know what to say. I'm feeling so left out.
The video is good. I just recommend Ranjini warms up before she tries the dance move. That's all.
Hey, do you know my name is actually the name of a dance? Ranjini is the name of a dance.
Okay, the listeners can hold on. Ranjini, we can describe
absorb
it to
that.
You.
Can we just let Twitter know that?
What's that thing, Periscope? Yeah. What's the thing where you can show what you're
that's
doing?
Right. And that's like the Indian version. It's like the ancient Indian version of Gangnam Style.
Can we Periscope this? She started to make it sound all just, like...
Yeah,
it's like,
so it's like an ancient novelty dance that kids did. Yeah.
Moving swiftly on.
All right, Ranjini's had enough. To something we know a bit more about. State of the Nation address happening next week.
Ooh.
Greg, I think you'll be covering that.
I think I'll be there with Ranjini. Are you coming down
full house? Escort.
Okay,
yeah, we're dates for that. So it's
sounds fantastic. It's the first I hear of that, but mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, there you go.
So
yeah, I don't know. We were talking. Richard and I were talking about this on our way in. That you know, in May, everybody's pumped up for a really dramatic Sona that's going to outdo last year's. I don't know if it is going to. I'm not sure. I get the sense from the economic freedom fighters that while they do want to make a point at the Sona, that they are not going, you know, I don't think that they want to get assaulted and thrown out of parliament this time. But there's another factor at play. It's a fees must fall movement. Mm. And Richard was making the point that, you know, the agenda may actually be controlled by fees must fall rather than the economic freedom fighters this time around. So I don't know what exactly is planned. But what we do know is that parliament is going to be like a military zone.
Mm.
For Sona, it's you know, there's all sorts of new security measures and things. So I think that, you know, it's going to be heavily controlled. Hopefully our signals won't be jammed, so you know, we'll be able to communicate with the world out there. But I don't know how many ordinary people, whether they come from the EFF or Fees Must Fall, will be able to get near the parliamentary precinct. We must know that from around midday, the precinct around parliament and the route that the president travels gets sealed off. So whoever wants to get there needs to get there earlier on. So if they're going to get there earlier on, they're going to be dealt with early.
According, within and the ambit of the law. I think
yes, and thrown out, thrown off the streets long before the president arrives. Yeah. If they plan for late, they won't be able to, I mean, it's going to be the police and the army. There. They're not going to get near the precinct, so they won't be able to stage any disruption.
It's not like the EFF's building it up and saying, you know, the president won't give this speech alone.
Yes, but the EFF is building it up for inside the house.
Okay.
They want to because basically what we've just heard Mbuyiseni and Lozi say is that every time the president speaks, the rand falls down. So they
that's a good one.
It's fairly accurate.
what effect is the Sona going to have? So yeah, it's the, you can see where their thinking is. That their thinking is not on pay back the money this time. They're leaving that to the case that goes to the Constitutional Court on the Tuesday before SONA. Mm. But their thinking is on the economy now and the effect of the president and his actions on South Africa's economy.
But the President Zuma, I think, is in a really, really difficult spot for this address, regardless of all the any potential protests or anything like that. Just the points of his speech, because of the economy. The GDP outlook for 2016 has just been, I think, lowered to something like 0.8% by the IMF. Business confidence is, I think, at a low since 1994. The public wage bill, I don't think he has much leeway to sort of reduce that. Of course, these things will have to tie in with the budget speech too, Pravin Gordhan's budget speech. But I don't think he has much leeway there to lower it because it's an election period, and I think sort of the public services, public sector unions would quite well protest if there are any significant movement on that. And then there are more demands. Already last year, the president announced how much did they spend to cover that zero fee increase at universities? I think it was 2.4 billion or 3 billion rand. And there are more demands for the government to institute or at least make a strong movement towards the implementation of free higher education. So essentially, we have this situation where the economy is tanking and things aren't looking good at all. And there are more and more demands in what is an election year.
Well, I mean, I think if I'm strategizing this year's SONA, and I love how it's turned into sort of an entertainment franchise. last year's was amazing. They're going to have to blow up Cape Town.
Coming up next week's State of the Nation address live in Cape Town
this summer. One man.
One speech.
It's like a. It really is. It's like Star Wars. It's unreal. But I think if I'm strategizing. What the ANC always does so well is sort of point. And you have the global economy tanking. You have China tanking. You have all these exogenous factors that are pushing down in our economy, which they genuinely are. Highlight those. We have a drought. Highlight the drought. We have a water crisis. Highlight the water crisis. That's surely not the ANC's fault that they don't control the rain. So I think there's going to be a lot of finger pointing, and not a lot of mea culpas. I don't think we're going to hear Jacob Zuma say sorry for canning his finance minister and hiring a guy who no one had heard of.
One of the other things I think we have failed to talk about is what's 2 days before the State of the Nation address, the issue of Nkandla is in the Constitutional Court.
That's huge, and I think what may happen there. Is it will take a lot of the wind out of the sails of SONA. Either that or it'll ramp the whole SONA confrontation up to, 11. And it literally will be the best episode in the franchise.
What I think Jacob Zuma will thank his lucky stars about, though, is that this is the hearing and not the judgment. If it was judgment, it would have been, it would have been Star Wars at Parliament because he would, but we don't know how the Constitutional Court will rule on the matter. But either way, I think the EFF would have gone to town with it. But it's going to be the hearing. And from what we hear, the EFF is pumping it up as a big march in Johannesburg. At the Constitutional Court. You must know that Public Protector Thuli Madonsela is the amicus curiae on that case. It's a very complex case. It's not only about whether the president should pay back the money or not, but about the powers of the public protector, and that has repercussions for all sorts of things, and the cases that she has pronounced on. So, she's got a lot riding on it as well. But I think that in terms of ensuring accountability in South Africa, which has been sorely missing, it has been, I think, the central core of why there is so much anger and bitterness at the president, his failure to account to the people of South Africa. I think that is why that case is so important to so many people.
I mean, Greg, you were using the SABC case as sort of a reference point on how
it's going to be quite interesting.
Nkandla case, Michael.
So the SABC case from the last elections in 2014.
Was that the elections case?
Not the elections. It's the Thadi
Motsoeneng.
I see what you're saying. Yeah,
so the public protector's report on that, she said Thadi should go through disciplinary procedures, and which was challenged. I think the general findings around the public protector's powers in that case were that her findings certainly cannot be ignored. She doesn't have the powers of a judge or a court, but unless that they have to be taken seriously, and you can't just go and administer other reports and investigations on this issue. You have to take them seriously and give them due consideration. And I think the courts went almost as far as saying that if you don't institute a review of the public protector's findings, you basically have to follow them. So it's going to be quite interesting to see how that influences this case. I think that's going to be the key. People will be talking, I think it was Judge Shippers, about their Shippers judgment quite a lot.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. It is an extremely complicated case because you must know that in terms of the Public Protector Act and the legislation governing her office, it spells out what you do if you dispute her findings. And what has happened is a bizarre series of events because once that 400 and whatever page report came out, first it was ignored for several months. Then the president sent Parliament a note to then investigate it. And then we've had two ad hoc committees. We've had the Minister of Police do his investigation. And I'm not sure on what authority because he doesn't have powers to revise her findings. He came up with an alternate set of findings. He came up with a video. And then Parliament chose, or the ad hoc committee, the ANC caucus in Parliament, opted to take his version or his findings as the gospel rather than this process that the public protector went through. So that is why that does have a major effect on how the public protector's office operates. And you must know the public protector steps down, Tuli Madonsela steps down as public protector at the end of this year. Yeah. So it's not just about her, but for that office in future as well.
It's going to be interesting to see when the results come out because we've got another 5 months, or so, I mean, the judgment comes out. Mm-hmm. We've got another 5 or so months until the elections. That could be quite interesting if that comes out, sort of just in the run up to the vote.
Yes, the Constitutional Court judgment.
Yeah. There's that, but I think we also underestimate to some degree how local municipal elections are, and I think any political party worth its salt certainly has these grand visions and these grand marches, but everybody's sort of rotating around this idea of 2019. To a large degree as well, and they'd be very wise to do so. With the municipal elections, I would caution thinking a report like that landing even a week or two before the election would have that much influence over what can be very, very, very local issues. I would like to say one thing about Tuli Madonsela, if I may. She made a recommendation yesterday on Twitter that on account of human trafficking, we should install tracking chips. Human trafficking. We should install, you know, it's a good idea to install tracking chips in our children.
Oh, jeez.
I think it's okay. She's had a hard time under constant criticism from the ANC.
She's got a lot going on, man.
It's understandable that she's going to lose it eventually.
I'm just nervous she's going to, you know, Moosey's going to be out of the DA. She's going to be in, you know, as president of the DA. And, you know, it's going to be like, she's going to be like the drone lady.
Your baby girl is going to have any tracking.
I mean, have to take my kids sense. To get
they could
chips
put,
installed.
They could put your ETOL tag in the chip, like your passport in the chip.
So what happens every time your kid crosses under an ETOL? That's what they get.
It beeps.
Bleep.
Every time they go under an ETOL gantry, you know where they are.
We've only got a few minutes left. Richard Poplack, you've got a book coming out.
I do. I have a book coming out on, it's landing on March 9th. It's called Continental Shift. A Journey Through Africa's Shifting Fortunes. I wrote it with Kevin Bloom, who's also a writer at Daily Maverick. We spent the last 5 years on it. We've traveled to many, many wonderful African countries, including Kenya. We were there, and it's been a huge trip. It's been wild. So, you know, it's an interrogation of this idea of Africa Rising, one of these phenomena that Kevin and I think understood quite early. That was linked to commodities and to everything that's happened in China. But at the same time, you have this rapidly expanding, urbanizing population that is changing the face of this continent very, very quickly and very, very interestingly. So, that's sort of what the book's about. And everyone should get a copy, at least one copy.
I mean, I'm curious with what's recently happened with China and their economy. Was there a temptation to go and add another chapter or like sort of scribble a bit of changes in there?
No, because the book's findings were sort of, you know, the questions we were asking back in 2006, I think, when we did our first trip together to Angola. We're like, well, what is this? We can see change. I mean, 2006 was 4 years after the civil war had ended in Angola. Mm. And the book sort of starts with us on the other side of the Kavango River, in a little town called Calais, which there were 7,000 people during the war. 4 years later, there's 34,000 people in this little town on the other side of the Kananga River looking over at Rundu in Namibia. And our questions simply were, is this booming because Angola is selling its oil to China? Or is it booming for some other reason? Is there real fundamental change happening in this country that's linked to actual growth? Or is this just an expanding GDP that has no real relationship to development? And that's really what the fundamental question that the book asks.
I mean, it's really interesting because just last week you were talking to someone from the Oromo Studies Association, I think, one of the big tribes in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And his major criticism of this economic development was it's just not being felt on the ground. And this trade-off between social justice and economic development is not real because economic development is not happening.
Well, we actually look at Ethiopia in quite some detail. One of our chapters plays out there. And it looks at the setting up of the first commodities exchange in Ethiopia, which unbelievably, until about 10, 12 years ago, even a leader as smart as Mela Zanawi had no idea what a commodities exchange was. And so they instituted one in Ethiopia. And the questions we ask again is, how does this very urban, very intelligent mechanism linking up food producers on the ground in Ethiopia with food sellers in a global economy, does that actually affect people on the ground? And the answer so often is no.
I can't wait to read this, man. I'm curious if there was anything that especially surprised you and you sat out and you were out there and you're like, okay, this I did not expect to.
Oh, no. I mean, it's from little stories like breaking down in the jungle in a war zone in the Central African Republic to just encountering people that are just so brilliant. In places that you just wouldn't expect. I mean, when you talk about the Ethiopia story, we were hanging out with this guy right in a place called Asosa, right in the middle of the green famine zone. And here's a guy who's just brilliant. You know, he's come from absolutely nothing, educated himself, smart as all hell, and is probably going to be the mayor of Asosa one day, and whose entire political framework is totally different from what's happening in Addis Ababa, thousands of kilometers away. And when you meet people like that, you realize that this continent really, really does have a future.
That's a hell of a throw forward to the book, man. I can't wait to read it. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. And Jenny, Richard Poplar, Greg, thank you so much for joining.
It was a pleasure.
Right. And good to be here. Hopefully we'll come back after sauna and we'll still have we'll have all our limbs still intact.
Please avoid the media holding area. We all know that's something else. And if someone dressed as a waiter offers you anything,
we may redefine what media holding area is.
We're going to install the Thule tracking chip in Jenny. As a
this is why
beta
we need the
project.
Tracking chip, man.
I want to have a media hugging area, so we spread the love.
No. I actually saw a tweet asking if you're single, so you probably don't want to talk about hugs.
Oh, hey.
Like, you just gave someone such hope, and this is going to the dogs now. We need to wrap this up. Thank you for listening. Share the podcast far and wide. Next
Jenny,
week.
Are you single?
This is CliffCentral.com.